This podcast is part of the C-Suite Radio Network, turning the volume up on business.
Welcome to the Keep Leading Podcast, a podcast dedicated to promoting leadership development and sharing leadership insights. Here's your host, the Leadership Accelerator, Eddie Turner.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Keep Leading Podcast, the podcast dedicated to leadership development and insights. I'm your host, Eddie Turner, the Leadership Accelerator. I work with leaders to accelerate performance and drive impact. When I planned the episode you are about to hear, it was with the thought of talking to Mr. John Perry, a man who was awarded the 2018 MECO Distinction of Thought Leader of the Year. And I wanted to talk about that and the work that he has done to help people create better tomorrows and empower themselves. As you listen to this episode, you're going to see that it takes a different turn than what I originally planned. This is perhaps one of the most deeply personal episodes I've ever recorded. As I record this, I hear my grandmother and my grandfather. I hear the conversations that they used to have and many of the stories they've told me. John Perry, if you have seen the movie Hidden Figures and how it reveals the accomplishments of three amazing Black women that went untold and unrecognized for years. Well, John Perry was a contemporary of those amazing women, and he too is a hidden figure. And his work has gone untold and unrecognized. And so I consider it a deeply personal and quite an honor to be able to have him tell his story on the show. And it takes me to a deeper place than what I anticipated and helps me to appreciate the importance of the voice that I have and the role that people like John Perry and those other amazing hidden figures have played in creating a pathway for people like me and my generation that would not be possible otherwise. So listen to this episode. And it is my sincere hope that all of us will see the need to keep leading in a different way as a result of listening to the story and the words of John Perry right after this.
This podcast is sponsored by Eddie Turner, LLC. Eddie Turner, LLC delivers executive and leadership coaching, professional speaking, facilitation services, and management consulting across the globe. Eddie Turner, LLC also creates voiceovers, serves as a master of ceremonies, as a panel and event moderator, and provides national media commentary. Visit EddieTurnerLLC.com to learn more.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Keep Leading Podcast, the podcast dedicated to leadership development and insights. I'm your host, Eddie Turner, the Leadership Accelerator. I work with leaders to accelerate performance and drive impact. Would you like to create a better tomorrow? My guest today is the 2018 MECO International Thought Leader of Distinction, and he is committed to helping individuals and organizations do just that. He helps people recall and honor their yesterdays, reveal and understand their today, and believe in and get excited about the promise of their tomorrows. I am talking about Mr. John Perry. Mr. Perry, welcome to the Keep Leading Podcast.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Now, you and I met last year at the MECO, which stands for Measuring Excellence in Executive Coaching Conference. And there you were awarded the designation of International Thought Leader of Distinction. So what I'd love for you to do is to tell my listeners a little bit about your background and how you earned that prestigious designation.
Well, basically, I grew up in Florida, and I was one of five siblings, and I grew up in a typical neighborhood in Florida, and always loved education, loved learning, so much so that I went to summer school whenever I could and gained a lot of insight about learning as I did so. And I caught my older sister in the seventh grade, so we went to middle school and high school together. After I graduated from high school, I went to college, and at the time, schools in Florida were segregated, so my options were limited. So I chose Florida A&M University in Tallahassee, which is only 170 miles from where I grew up in Jacksonville. And I majored in mathematics. I had originally wanted to be a doctor and just changed my mind, decided I wanted to be an architect. And Florida A&M didn't offer architecture degrees, so I chose math. And graduated from FAMU. In fact, it will be 60 years ago this Saturday. My graduation was June 1st, 1959.
Well, congratulations. That is fantastic. Now, I'm going to get back to your MECO designation here in a moment, but you said a couple things here that I would like to address. Number one, I remember when I just saw you at the conference. I saw you. You're a distinguished-looking man. And I remember just you were like on the top of the staircase. My listeners can't see me waving and gesturing right now, but I saw you at the top of the staircase, and I'm like, I need to meet him. There just was something about you. And then just from the way I was raised, you know, just respecting my elders. And you look like a walking history book. And then you gave your speech and not a pin could be heard dropping. You had everyone mesmerized. And then you actually had a lot of people laughing at certain points. We went from quiet and silence and awe to you really had the gift of gab and had us laughing. So when you talk about the fact of how you had to make certain educational decisions, because at that time in America, Black people's options were limited and you could not pursue the path you really wanted to pursue, but you went in a different route and you still found success. And I love that and I admire that. And then also at a time where many Black people were not getting higher education. So for you to pursue higher education at all, at a time when many were only getting high school and sometimes only grade school educations, but then to be able to go on and have success. Can you talk about that a little bit for us?
My good fortune was being born to parents who were relatively uneducated, even for the standards of that day. My mother had a sixth grade education and my father had a third grade education, but they both understood the importance of education as our ticket to ride out of the circumstance that they grew up within. And so education was almost preordained for me because I graduated from high school at the age of 15. But what does a 15-year-old do? I couldn't get a job because they had child labor laws back in the day. So all I could do was go to school. So I went to school and graduated at the age of 19 with a bachelor's degree in mathematics. And I knew that I didn't want to teach. I didn't know what I wanted to do with that degree, but I knew that I didn't want to teach math. And so I started looking for jobs and couldn't find one in the South, of course. That was a different time. And so I decided I would apply for jobs in Arizona, New Mexico, and California. And the first offer I got was from the NASA High-Speed Flight Station at Edwards, California. And they offered me a job as an aeronautical research engineer. I didn't know what that was, but I figured if they're going to give me a shot at it, I'm going to take that shot.
You say you didn't know what it was, but if they offer it, you figure I can do it, huh?
I'm going to give it a shot. I'm going to prove to them that I can't, if I can't.
So they gave you the shot at being an aeronautical research engineer for NASA.
Right.
And so when you said that to us, I remember that. And I remember as you went through your story, immediately what came to my mind and what may be coming to the mind of my listeners is many of them have seen the movie Hidden Figures. And Hidden Figures explores the history of three relatively unknown Black women who made immense contributions to America's journey into space. And so because of that movie, we have a deeper appreciation for them and what they did and the price they paid. So you really are one of those hidden figures who many people have not had a chance to hear about. So I just wanted to say that and now let you say a little bit more about your journey at NASA.
Well, the era of the hidden figures was my era because the time around which that story was written was 1961. By 1961, I had 2 years experience as an aeronautical research engineer. And by then, I am now the project manager for the X-15 simulator. And as you may or may not know, X-15 is a rocket-powered airplane that helped us explore the fringes of space. So we were working on the journey to space from the aeronautical standpoint and moving out into space as our flight plans dictated. So I got the opportunity to work with people like Neil Armstrong and Pete Knight and those guys who later became famous for their exploits. As it turns out, and I didn't realize until somebody, one of my former NASA colleagues called me, told me, well, my name shows up in the book, Hidden Figures.
And oh, really?
I didn't know how the author got my name. And I contacted her by LinkedIn, I think, but I never got a response. But yes, I was named and my job title was in the book, Hidden Figures. Mm-hmm. And so I was among those ladies. The difference for me was I never experienced the treatment they experienced. And when I watched the movie, I was not aware how close to the surface my emotions were about that kind of treatment.
Mm. Tell me a little bit more about that, if you will. You said when you watched it, you had an emotional response. Can you talk about what that response was?
Yeah, well, like the simple thing, like having to walk a quarter mile to use a restroom, not being able to drink out of the white water fountain. And I remember having had the same experiences. I remember once my family and I, after I became an engineer, went back home to visit my family in Florida. We were taking a trip to their homeland, which was Alabama. And we were on this road headed that way and wanted to stop and use the restroom. And there were 2 carloads of us. And so I went to the restroom, the colored restroom. And it was so filthy, it looked like it had never been cleaned. Mm-hmm. So I decided that no woman that I knew would use that restroom. So I walked into the service station, got the white restroom key off the hook, and went and opened the white restroom for my sisters and parents and wife to use. And as soon as the owner or the worker at the service station saw that, he finished serving the customer, then jumped in his pickup truck and raced away. And so I'm saying, wait a minute, have I just cost us our lives because this?
Oh my goodness,
Georgia.
Yes.
And so we headed on down the road towards Alabama. About 10 minutes later, this sheriff's car approached us from the rear. And I thought this was it. Okay, mm-hmm. We're going to be found out in the woods somewhere. But he wasn't interested in us. He went on by us and went on about his business. So we survived that experience. But that movie brought back all of those experiences, like having to stand behind the white line on the bus, no matter how crowded it was in the back. We were not allowed to sit in front of the white line on the back, so we'd be standing up in the back and there'd be nobody in the front. And as a freshman in college, we started a boycott of the bus company because a lady got arrested because she dared sit in the front of the bus when it was almost empty, and the bus driver pulled over, called the cops, and she was arrested. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of thing that came back to the surface for me as I watched that movie. My good fortune was I went to work for a leader. Our chief executive would not tolerate that kind of behavior in his organization.
So you had a chance even that early on when the rest of the country had not caught up to what it meant to treat people civilly and like a human being. You actually had a leader in the true sense of the word that went against the grain and treated you differently.
Right. And what was amazing to me as I reflect on that, is that's how I started to define for myself what leadership is and what it looks like. Because what he understood as a leader was his job was to inspire excellence. His job was to do those things that would inspire us to commit our best in that service. Because Kennedy had opened his mouth and said, we're going to land a man on the moon by the end of the decade and return him to Earth safely. we had a key role to play in that journey. He knew that he needed the best talent available, and somehow I slipped through, but I'm glad I did.
Okay, I'm sure you did more than slip through.
And so what he knew was we had to come to work every day committed to giving our best in that quest. And so he wanted to get all the garbage that would prevent us from doing that out of the way. And so as a part of my speech, as you just mentioned, it was those lessons that I learned during his leadership that has helped me form what I consider to be the leadership challenge for today. And during the leadership development work that I do for my clients, I realized that that kind of leadership is rare even 50, 60 years later.
Yes.
Because people don't know how to leadership. A lot of people still think leadership is about position, title, salary, size of office. Leadership is about behavior.
Yes.
And it's what you do habitually that inspire others to commit their best in your service. And this guy got it, even in the 50s and 60s. In fact, he was instrumental in forming the first Equal Employment Opportunity Committee at our facility, which I chaired for the first 10 years of its existence. He also recognized after a while that all of the engineers were white and male. And he knew there had to be other engineers who looked like me who could do good engineering work. So he looked at where are we recruiting? So we're recruiting at places where we were not likely to find female nor others of people of color. So we started recruiting to historically black colleges and universities, to his Hispanic serving university. In fact, I went on a recruiting trip to Georgia Tech. And at the time, Georgia Tech was graduating more female engineers than any institution in the country. And so
wow.
He was very proactive in making sure that he gave everybody a chance to make that commitment. And he would let nobody stand in the way of that. In fact, our entire aircraft mechanic corps was white at the time. There was one guy who looked white, but he was kind of darker skinned. And it turned out he was Puerto Rican. And they thought he was black. And they gave him all kinds of trouble. Once our leader found out about that, he said, no, this ain't happening. So he went out and recruited a black mechanic who was getting ready to retire from the Air Force. And he was smart enough to recruit the right person to break the color barrier in that society. There was a guy who was well-respected, very talented. He was big physically, so if anybody gave him a whole lot of lip, he could probably punch him out.
Okay.
He came in and just did his job. And that was the beginning of integrating the technical support staff. So this guy did all this stuff consciously. This didn't happen by accident, because this was the 60s after all. And so I got fortunate to get in the organization of a real leader who showed me what leadership is and what it feels like.
So you got a chance to work with a leader that showed through example what leadership is. You were able to experience what it felt like because he offered a certain level of protection and direction for you and others who were under his leadership.
Right.
You gave us a lot there, Mr. Perry. You talked about the emotion you felt when you saw the movie Hidden Figures, that you were contemporaries with those amazing women. And you are mentioned in the book, and you have had similar experiences to what they have had. But because of the leadership that you worked under, you sound like you did not, at a certain point, have to go through some of those same things. Things got a little bit better. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. I never experienced that. Because, in fact, NASA was my sanctuary because the city I lived in was not a lot different from the city I left.
Okay.
I still got evicted from my first hotel. I got evicted from my first house that I shared with some other engineers because once they found out I was in there, they evicted all four of us. I was a few service in restaurants. So living in this town didn't feel a whole lot different from living in Jacksonville. Only thing was, there were no signs saying colored only or white only.
How about that?
But the behavior was the same. So when I walked into the building at NASA, I was safe. I was John, who was an engineer who could help us land a man on the moon. And nobody cared about the color of the package that the talent came in.
Look at that. No one cared about the color of the package that the talent came in.
Right.
I like that.
It was just, like I said, that was my sanctuary. So when I went to work, man, I was in hog heaven.
Then so you had to go to work to get relief from the times.
Right. And like when I first got married, which is almost 58 years ago now, we had a tough time finding a place to stay. And we got every excuse from, we don't rent to your kind, to, we're not prejudiced, but some of our neighbors might be, and we don't want you to get hurt.
Wow.
And so we looked all over town for a place and finally had to resort to going to another black couple who owned a house here in town that had been transferred, the job had been transferred to a city about 90 miles away, and his house was for rent. So we rented from him and stayed there for 6.5 years and vowed that once we found a house we wanted to buy, we would spend every dollar we could get our hands on to fight the system if we were denied the opportunity to buy it. Fortunately, the real estate agent I was dealing with was doing real estate part-time, and he was an engineer at NASA. So I worked with him all day, and then I dealt with him when I was looking for a house in the evening. And so he told me, if you have that problem, this housing tract, I'll go to court with you. And so I never had that problem. We bought the house that we wanted, and we come October 15th, we would have been in there 50 years. And so
You've been in the same house since that day?
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
50 years.
So you've been married 58 years. Yeah. So that means that it took you all 8 years to get a home.
Yeah, well, we weren't ready the first few years.
Okay.
And when we were ready, it happened pretty quickly because of the agent. Because during that time, real estate agents had 2 3x5 card boxes. That was long before internet and all that. And so one card box was for black folks, the other card box for everybody else. So we never even got to see properties in neighborhoods that they wanted to keep segregated.
No, that's what I meant. It took you that long because of the times that a couple like you couldn't get a home easily because of what was unfolding in our nation.
That's right. That's okay. Right. And there were neighborhoods in our city that they wanted to keep segregated. And a lot of us ended up there because there were a lot of FAA, air traffic controllers, a lot of engineers from the Air Force, a lot of engineers from NASA. And so we had a real black community here in town, and we used to socialize together. And so we decided, as we got to the point where we wanted to buy a house, that we would not buy in the same neighborhood. If one couple bought in one neighborhood, the other couple would have to go to another neighborhood because we were not going to allow them to use us to segregate neighborhoods.
Okay. Okay.
So next thing you know, there were no all-white neighborhoods in Lancaster.
All right.
So there were one of us everywhere.
Well, I'm impressed, obviously. And by the way, congratulations, 58 years of marriage. That's just outstanding. And then the ability to stay in the same home for 50 years. I mean, I don't have any words. I mean, it's just incredible. And I'm enjoying this conversation with you, Mr. Perry, because as I thought when I saw you and as I got a chance to listen to you then and as I'm listening to you now, I literally have chills. The amount of history that you have lived that I only can read about or that I have heard from my parents and grandparents, especially at that time, the average male only getting a third grade education, the average black woman getting only a sixth grade education. That was common then.
Yes.
And how far we have come. So I'd like to go ahead at this point and just pause for a moment. As much as I hate to hit the pause button, I want to pause for a moment and just have a word from our sponsor.
This podcast is sponsored by Eddie Turner, LLC. Organizations who need to accelerate the development of their leaders call Eddie Turner the Leadership Accelerator. Eddie works with leaders to accelerate performance and drive impact. Call Eddie Turner to help your leaders one-on-one as their coach, or to inspire them as a group through the power of facilitation or a keynote address. Visit EddieTurnerLLC.com to learn more.
This is Laura Gassner-Odding, founder and chief catalyzing officer of Limitless Possibility, and you're listening to the Keep Leading podcast with Eddie Turner.
Okay, everyone, we're back, and we are talking with Mr. John Perry. And Mr. John Perry works with people to help them recall and honor their yesterdays, reveal and understand their today, and get excited about the promise of tomorrow. But he really is one of NASA's hidden figures. And so we haven't even gotten a chance to talk about the work that he does today yet. We're still talking about his history at NASA. And, you know, you took me down memory lane with some of the stories that my parents used to tell me there, Mr. Perry, and hearing about you and your educational achievements in spite of the times and what we had to go through. And what you're telling me now, it's not that it was that long ago. We're a short time removed from what you are describing.
Yeah, I was talking with my wife and my sister, who is into genealogy, and she looked at our family history. And what I realized that we're not so far removed from that dreadful day when we were enslaved, because I knew my great-grandmother on my mother's side, and she was born a slave in 1863.
Wow.
And so we think that we're so far removed that nobody ever knew a slave or nobody ever had a slave, but I'm approaching my 80th birthday, and I knew a former slave. So we still have some work to do, and we still have to develop the ability to talk about the journeys we all travel, because each of us has been shaped by the journeys we travel to get to this place, and what's precious about each other, what about each of us, and what's worthy of each other's respect is the journey we travel. But we don't listen to the stories about the journey, so we don't know each other. We know about each other, but we don't know each other. And as a leadership development consultant, one of the biggest challenges I face is the leader doesn't know the people he or she is trying to inspire. Mm. That's what makes leadership so difficult.
Yes.
And so you got to know the people.
Well, you know, I brought you on to talk about one thing. And as you started talking about the work that you did there at NASA, and you just talked about, you know, just this journey, this history of people of the Black heritage, I feel like I should have had you on for a completely different subject now. And man, I feel like I got to have you on for another interview, because I'm not even going to be able to touch everything you accomplished at NASA. But can you just give us the top three things you'd say in your storied career at NASA that you achieved? And as I'm asking this question, in my mind's eye, I'm seeing some of the slides you shared with us there in Denver. Can you share just a couple of those with my audience, please?
Sure. Well, I think the first leadership lesson I learned at NASA was leaders believe in and sometimes for others until others believe in and for themselves. I was 6 weeks into my NASA career, just turned 20. My supervisor calls me into the office and says, John, I want you to build this orbital rendezvous simulator.
A who? Say that one more time for me.
Orbital rendezvous simulator.
All right.
So it's a way to simulate two bodies orbiting in space and rendezvousing. And he said, I'm going to assign you this technician who will do all of the building of the hardware. You write the program and implement the program on a computer. And we want to set it up so that pilots can practice. Well, I say, if you think I can do it, I'm dumb enough to try. So I went to work. And lo and behold, we built that thing. And it was a funny looking contraption because it had some pretty primitive hardware. And I figured no self-respecting test pilot will spend 5 minutes in this thing. As it turned out, pilots would come and spend hours practicing how to rendezvous with another body orbiting in space. So like 2 months, 3 months into my NASA career, I realized that I had talents that I didn't think I had. But my leader, my supervisor, saw in me something I didn't see in myself. And if he had never challenged me to build that simulator, I probably would never have known that I was capable of doing so.
That's a powerful lesson. So by him believing in you before you could believe in yourself, you were able to tap into hidden talent that you didn't even realize you had.
Right. I had no clue I was capable after only 6 weeks of meeting that challenge.
But and it had more of an impact than what you anticipated.
Oh, yeah. Now I figure I'm bulletproof.
Okay.
But not quite. Not quite.
But not quite. Okay.
Well, the next major challenge that I was offered was to become the project manager on the X-15 simulator. Of course, like I said earlier, the X-15 was this rocket-powered airplane that helped us explore the fringes of space. And it was a monstrosity in terms of the computer equipment it used, and it had what we call an iron bird simulator, which was a physical replica of the airplane itself that was several hundred feet away, connected to the computer by cable. That whole thing was my responsibility, and my job was to make sure that it was a faithful representation of the airplane itself. And so the second lesson I learned during that project was the leader clearly articulates expectations and holds people accountable for meeting them. So I knew what my job was. I knew I had to make sure the simulator was ready for the pilot to come down and practice. The last thing I wanted to do was have a test pilot waste his time on a simulator that I hadn't gotten prepared. So I knew exactly what I had to do. I developed a process by which I tested the accuracy of the simulator in the profiles. We had high speed and high altitude profiles. I had a test for each. And so if we were practicing for high altitude flights, I would make sure it met the criteria for accuracy in high altitude simulations. If we're having a high speed flight, I made sure it met the expectations. The pilots would come and spend hours and hours. And then they go off and fly the airplane. And as soon as they got back and took their pressure suits off, we would have a debriefing. And they would say how faithful the simulation was, how accurately I had simulated what they would experience in the air. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it didn't work as well as I had hoped. And the leader would make sure I knew.
Okay.
But no mistake was fatal unless you repeated it too often. Because the leader would say, okay, John, that one didn't work. What are you going to try next? And what do you need in terms of time and money to try the next thing? And so we were allowed to make mistakes. And that's the only way we learned. If we know the answer to the question, why bother asking it?
Okay.
So we were doing research and development. That's what it's all about. Answer questions that maybe don't even have an answer, but you'll find out.
Mm-hmm.
Ask a question and explore. So that was the second lesson. Set clear expectations and hold people accountable for meeting them.
Wow. Thank you for sharing those two very important lessons. Now, you accomplished a lot during your career, but somehow you pivoted. You went from being an aeronautical engineer with all of the inventions that you were responsible for and some of the patents that we haven't talked about to leadership development consulting, where you've even written your own assessment. Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah, well, basically, I experienced exemplary leadership for the first 20 years of my NASA career. And so when I got a new manager who didn't know what leadership was and certainly didn't know how to do leadership, it changed my experience of work. And he was more command and control.
Okay.
The leader had rights and privileges. And as the chief financial officer, which I was at the time, because I had gone back to school and gotten an MBA. And so I came back to NASA after my engineering management career. I came back to NASA as the CFO. And as a CFO, I know what the rules were. We're responsible for protecting the taxpayer trust. So leaders, I don't care how high they are in the organization, have no privileges. They only have rights. And so the new leader I got thought that because he was my boss, he could order me to do things that I knew would get us both in trouble. And so I refused to follow those orders. And if it just happened once every week or two, I probably would have survived. But every day, 5 minutes after he walked into his office and put his lunch down, he would be in my office on me about something. And then I started having all the stress-related ailments, headaches, sleepless nights, weight loss, all that stuff we do to ourselves. Ended up having to go through therapy to deal with all of that stuff. And I realized I didn't want to live my life that way. So within 3 years of being able to retire with lifelong financial security, I just walked out.
You were under so much pressure and stressor from this gentleman that you walked out ahead of getting your full retirement.
Right.
That is so sad to hear.
And I did it. Nobody made me do it. I did it myself. So I don't blame anybody for that. I chose to.
No, just the fact that you were in that kind of environment to where your only source of relief was to walk away to get your sanity back. That's sad. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, that was a big move for me. But fortunately, I have a wife who said, I'd rather have you alive and sane.
Yes.
Than a steady paycheck and don't even know what day it is.
Yes.
And she had her own career. She was a teacher, and so she was not dependent upon me. I was the primary breadwinner, but that was not an issue for her. She was much more concerned about my health.
No, the other thing is I want to just address the fact that I forgot about the fact you also were the CFO. I remembered the engineering component of your career, but the fact that you went back and then got an MBA, came back and was the CFO? I mean... You something else, I tell you.
I was in the right place at the right time and was able to take full advantage of the circumstances. And so one of the lessons that my parents taught me that I don't want to forget to mention is they always taught us as we were growing up, all five of us, don't let how people treat you define who you are.
Yes.
And so
yes.
I never owned other people's treatment of me. So I never personalized the way my last manager treated me.
Don't let the way other people treat you define yourself. Is that what it was?
Who you are.
So say it one more time for a moment. Make sure we get that because that was golden.
Don't let the way others treat you define who you are.
Okay. Thank you.
And so one of the first questions I ask as I recognize the fact that I had to leave NASA was what compels a person to, within 3 years of retirement, leave a job he had hoped to retire from? And so that was what set me off on this journey of trying to find out the answer to that question. What happens to people in the workplace that makes it so unbearable that they will take significant risk to escape that place? Because it had happened to me. I know what it felt like. It wasn't like I read a book. I lived that for 2 years. And so I knew how miserable I was. And so I started just talking to people and got the opportunity to work with some folks, and they had some similar questions. And we decided there had to be a way to produce results that explain the source of people's pain or joy at work. And that was the genesis of the development of the job person environment assessment, which puts the person in the workplace. And it's based on who he or she is and how he or she sees the job as it needs to be done and the environment within which he or she is asked to do the job. And a summary of it is an assessment of energy. How much energy do you have left at the end of a typical workday? And so I believe that we need to have enough energy at the end of our workday with which to make a life, because we need to make a living, but we also need to make a life. If I leave it all at the company store, then when I leave work, I have nothing left with which to make a life. And that's sad. I didn't want to be in that place. And now I know how to help people avoid that place for themselves if they choose to.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I want to tie this back, what you're saying here, with something else you said a minute ago that I wanted to highlight. You talked about how you were working for a man that was instructing you to do things that you knew would get you both into trouble. And in light of some of the things we see unfolding in the news today, that's a leadership lesson in itself that we could talk about for an hour. But I like how you had the moral fortitude and you had strong ethics not to let someone else who was in a higher position dictate to you what you should do that would have you violate that. And then you go on to create this assessment that helps people figure out where they are and how they are at the end of their work day, because this was costing you your satisfaction in the work day. Right. So this assessment you use in helping to develop other leaders today, you were telling me when we were together, the success you've had in developing leaders.
Yeah, well, what I try to get them to do is make informed choices. I can only help people identify and explore options. I can also help them evaluate likely consequences for each of the choices they might make. But I can't tell them what to do. And I work even with sixth graders. I modified my service to be suitable for kids as early as sixth grade because I think prevention might be less frustrating than remediation. Mm-hmm. And I've had sixth graders ask me, Mr. Perry, what should I do? I said, hey, I have enough trouble trying to figure out what I should do. So I'm going to help you figure out what your options are, because if you have no options, you have no choice. So the first job I have is to help you identify and explore options.
Yes.
So once you come up with two or more options, now you have a choice. Now, if you do this, this is what's likely to happen. How valuable is that to you? If you do this, this is what's likely to happen. How valuable is that to you? Pick the one that's going to lead to the most favorable outcomes and lessons for you. And so that's really what I do, help people ask and answer for themselves the important questions, because I don't have answers for anybody. I don't even have answers for myself in a lot of cases. Okay. So I help them find their own answers. And as long as they're willing to own the consequences of the choices they make, that is, take responsibility for what happens as a result of what they do, then they are empowered. They might be in jail, they might be on the streets, but it's on them.
And then you also, when we talk about helping people create better tomorrows as a leader, you have a three-step process that you use. Can you just briefly tell us about that three-step process to help us create better tomorrows?
Well, first step is recalling and honoring their yesterdays. Oftentimes, we don't give ourselves enough credit for the achievements we have made and obstacles we have overcome in order to make those achievements, because we don't recall our stories. So I try to help people tell their stories, use the chance of their birth and the circumstances of their lives to tell their story. And I try to have them tell it to somebody who's interested in listening as a learner and not a judge. And what I do is I make sure that the listener is looking for those gems of inestimable value. As you know, I use in my work this quote from Baha'u'llah, and the title of which is The Potential of Man and the Importance of Education. And it goes like this: regard man as a mind rich in gems of inestimable value. Education can alone cause it to reveal its treasures and enable mankind to benefit therefrom. What that says to me is those gems of inestimable value can be found in the stories we tell about the journey we travel to get to this place. Mm-hmm. And the listening part is important, is that when I'm listening to your story, I'm looking for that which is precious about you, that which makes you worthy of my respect, regardless of your circumstance. And I defy you, if you listen to somebody's story about their journey, to not find at least one precious gem in the story.
Okay.
And so that's the recalling and honoring the past. The revealing and understanding the present is what the JPA does. It's a snapshot in time. This is where I am today. This is who I am. This is where I see my circumstance. So I use that to help them understand the source of their joy or pain in the workplace. And then the third step is believing in and getting excited about the promise of their tomorrows. First thing, I have to help them do a dream of possibility. Because if you can't see possibilities beyond your current circumstance, I would suggest your future's in somebody else's hands. So I help them envision a future. And then help them write a plan. And I use the book that I wrote, Creating the Future of Your Choice, as a guide for that process. Because out of that process comes a plan that they write for themselves with the help of the coach or consultant that they then make a commitment to execute. And it's designed to help them create better tomorrows. So that's the process that I use.
All right. So step one was to recall and honor their yesterdays.
Right.
Step two was reveal and understand their today. And step three is believe in and get excited about the promise of their tomorrows. And right. You have documented this as a companion tool. Your book in the title was, again,
Creating the Future of Your Choice. The subtitle is A Do-It-Yourself Guide to Empowerment.
Beautiful. I love that. And this is all what part of led to you becoming the 2018 MECO International Thought Leader of Distinction. Am I correct?
Yes. That was the criteria they used.
Yes. Boy, oh boy.
My body of work for the last 37 years.
Yes. Wow. What a testimony to your body of work, and what a privilege to be able to have access to your thought leadership through some of your writings. And boy, I'm getting kind of tongue-tied even just thinking about it, what I want to say to you next. I'm just in awe of you. I truly am in awe of you. And I am so grateful that you took the time to come on the show and talk with me and my listeners today. What would you say if we were thinking about summarizing this lesson, this session? We talked a lot about leadership, and would it be that leadership is something that you said earlier is a behavior, not a position and title? Right. What would you say how we can summarize our conversation today?
Well, I think the key is leaders inspire others to achieve, and it's what they do habitually that inspires those others. And bottom line is the challenge of leadership is getting to know those who you're trying to inspire. so that you will know more about what is likely to be inspiring to them. That's why I make a distinction between leadership and management.
Yes.
A lot of people are comfortable being managers because management is ensuring compliance. So all you have to do in order to ensure compliance is the rules and make sure people comply with the rules. Show up on time, don't abuse lunch breaks, take your breaks when prescribed, all of that stuff. That's management. Leadership is about inspiring commitment. And in order to inspire people to commit their best in yourself, you have to know the people. That's a whole lot harder than knowing the rules.
Yes.
And so I think the key for me is I see a lot of management. In fact, one of my colleagues likes to say most organizations we serve are overmanaged and underled.
Mm. Overmanaged and underled. Well, thank you for that nice summary. So, Mr. Perry, on the Keep Leading podcast, we like to give leaders a thought, a quote, a story, something that they can use that helps them keep leading. Do you have something you'd like to share with leaders to help them keep leading?
Yes, there's a quote by B.C. Forbes, a Scottish journalist who lived between 1880 and 1954. And I think it says, all we need to know about what success is. And it goes like this. The man who has done his level best and who is conscious that he has done his best is a success, even though the world may write him down a failure.
I like that. I like that. Thank you very much. Now, where can my listeners learn more about Mr. John J. Perry?
Well, my website is www.hpsonline.com. And that's where most of the services I offer are outlined, at least, and there are links to other websites that I have, one for the assessment itself, one for the student development work that I do. I also have blogged. That's the hub of all things human productivity systems. And I happen to be the founder and president of Human Productivity Systems.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to put that in the show notes so that everyone can have access to it, so they can connect with you, read about you. I'm also going to put a link to your book so they can go to Amazon and get a copy of your book. And definitely just, you are a gem and a true treasure. And I thank you again for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure talking with you, as always.
And I want to thank you as well for listening. This concludes this episode. I'm Eddie Turner, the Leadership Accelerator, reminding you that leadership is not about our title or our position, as Mr. Perry so eloquently stated for us today. Leadership is an activity. Leadership is action. It's not a case of once a leader, always a leader. It's not a garment we put on and take off. We must be a leader at our core and allow it to emanate in all we do. So, whatever you are doing, always keep leading.
Thank you for listening to your host, Eddie Turner, on the Keep Leading podcast. Please remember to subscribe to the Keep Leading podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen. For more information about Eddie Turner's work, please visit eddieturnerllc.com.
Thank you for listening to C-Suite Radio, turning the volume up on business. This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.